Romans 1 is where we've left off. We want to start with Romans chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. As you look through those introductory verses, Paul, as he's talking to the Romans, he's letting them know that he's concerned about them. We'll have more to say about that tonight. He has also said that he is someone who has been praying for them. That's really where we left off last week. We'll pick up with Romans 1, 8 to go back and resume the thought. Then we'll pick up with Romans 1, 9 and 10. In 1:8, and you may have this as a paragraph break, at least that's how it is in the ASV, he says, "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is proclaimed throughout the whole world." You may remember last time that we talked about the fact that people, congregations, workplaces, their reputations, even products have reputations. You buy this brand or you buy this. I remember a fellow way back when in the service, he bought Napa Auto Parts. Now, I'm not sure that he had it right or if he did, but he told me if you go into a Napa parts store and you don't buy the gold line, at least that's what it was way back when, the quality of the part is no different than AutoZone. You might be getting a cheap part. But if you buy that upper tier part, you're actually getting that quality that you would expect from a Napa store. So people, when you think about reputations, it's an important thing for us. He says you have a reputation, it's proclaimed throughout the whole world. Then 9 and 10. "For God is my witness, whom I serve in my spirit in the gospel of his Son, how unceasingly I make mention of you always in my prayers, making request, if by any means now, at length I may be prospered by the will of God to come unto you." Paul tells these Christians, I spend a lot of time in prayer. And as I spend a lot of time in prayer, who am I thinking about? Who am I praying for? You. Wouldn't that encourage you? Wouldn't you like to know that somebody not only prays for you, but somebody prays for you a lot? That's a good thing to do. If you tell somebody, I pray for you, they might be wondering, well, I wonder how often that is. Does that mean once a month or once every 6 months? You tell somebody, I pray for you, how often? Every day. How's that make them feel? Well, they're somebody who matters to you. There's someone who is special in your life. What if you bump it up a little bit? What if you told someone, I not only pray for you every day, I pray for you every day, how much? A lot. You're often in my prayers. What a great thing to say. What an encouragement. That's one of the things that we can do. This is, as we talked about a little last week, 1 Thessalonians 5:17, an example of praying without seeking. One author noted some reasons why he personally felt like he was sometimes hindered when he prayed. I want to discuss those four or five items with you. Number one, he said sometimes he had the sneaking feeling that prayer doesn't work. You think Christians have that sneaking feeling? Prayer doesn't work.
Young Christian.
All right. It could be that someone who is a young Christian would have that thought. Why else might someone have the sneaking feeling that prayer doesn't work?
You see, so many family members have come down with a cancer or some other disease or something. Three or four at a time. It just really winds you down.
Yeah. It may not be to the same extent as Job. But if you start going through those trials and tribulations, you're starting to wonder after a time, God, how much? And are you still with me? Are you anywhere near? Any other reasons why people, as they think about prayer, might have a sneaking suspicion that it doesn't work? Let's see, I was trying to figure out where it was coming from. Margaret, sorry.
It doesn't happen right away.
That's another consideration that's important. When we want something done, some of tonight's class is going to follow what we talked about a little Sunday from our study in Acts chapter 16. It's just the nature that we're sort of colliding a little bit. But that, Margaret, would be in line with what we were talking about Sunday. Sometimes it doesn't happen right away. Paul wanted to preach the gospel in that province of Asia, and God said, no, the Holy Spirit forbid him. Later that was possible, but sometimes we have to wait, and people get discouraged about prayer for that reason. Gary, and then maybe Stan.
Along with that is when our prayers aren't answered in the way we think they should be, either with a no or a not now, or just, I mean, don't creep into anyone's life at any time based on what they're doing, what going through.
Mm-hmm. Expect, well, imagine telling an animal, I'm going to give you a treat. If you've ever done that and your animal, dog, cat, whatever that might be, is familiar with what you mean when you say those words or you go over and shake the box, what's the expectation?
Now.
At least that's how it works in our house. That does not mean in 20 minutes. I mean, 20 minutes to our little dog is like 20 days, 20 years. Now, it's really difficult sometimes. This goes back to what Margaret was saying just a few minutes ago. It's really difficult to, if we don't have some kind of immediate sense or it's not answered in the particular way, it's not really effective. It's not really working. Stan?
Well, this one may be a little harder to digest, but prayer is not something that's to be taken lightly or flippantly. And if a person has not really attuned themselves to God, as we've had discussion in the past about God being a spirit must be worshipped in truth and spirit. And what does in spirit mean? Well, that's a very deep
subject.
Serious, I don't know how, there's probably several words for it, but whatever. And prayer is the same way. It's a part of that. And so there may be, because you're asking why may people feel like they're not being answered, they just may not be praying properly.
I'm just going to add to that, because that's probably the best way to sum up this particular point. A person may not be in Christ. They're not in the right relationship with God. For that reason, they expect the prayer to work. Biblically, though, they should not have that expectation. A related consideration, when we think about that, is that you have someone who, there are times, I don't know that I can give you a specific example right off, but someone buys some contraption. For example, they've got a new remote. They have 52 buttons on the thing, and they put in the batteries correctly, and it doesn't work. I got my new remote, supposed to do all these great newfangled things. Batteries are in properly. It doesn't work. Call the company that made it and say, I want to send it back. Well, is it possible that the remote is bad? Sure. Is it also possible that the remote is perfectly good, but the person didn't take the time to figure out that you've got to hit buttons A, B, and C before you can do all your newfangled things? Yes. Tying that in with what Stan was saying a little bit ago, sometimes people do not approach prayer or use prayer in a right way. It's flippant. Well, I'll just throw that, as I've said so many times, against the dartboard, against the wall, and see if God does something. It's not going to hurt. If you're approaching prayer in that way, you shouldn't have any expectation of God hearing it. Item number two, as far as things that can impede our prayers, what about feelings of personal guilt, personal unworth? You think that hinders people? You want something from somebody, and you have to ask them for a favor, but as you look at them, what are you thinking? Uh-oh.
They look like they're in a bad mood.
Yeah, they're in a bad mood. He's the guy that I told off. I don't want to go see him or talk to him. God, I'm unworthy. That can be a problem when it comes to prayer. Paul had apparently overcome those things. What about a schedule that's too full for habitual prayer? Big problem, I think, for a lot of people in America right now. Young people, old people, we always seem to be running or polled, or we have this going on or that going on. Item number four, going back to some of the things that we were talking about in last Sunday's class, ignorance about which to pray. That can lead to boredom in prayer. Anybody ever watch an old rerun on TV? An old rerun? Old movie that you've seen several times? Are you just glued to the set? Man, this is the best Andy Griffith show ever. It's my 39th time I've seen it. That's not quite it, is it? It is easy when you're so familiar with something to become bored. Prayer can suffer from that same problem. Going back to what we're talking about in our Sunday class, ignorance when it comes to God's will. That's a problem. If you're facing decision A and decision B and you're not really sure what to do, you might feel somewhat frustrated in prayer. That can impede, that can disturb prayer. Finally, realizing this is another biggie, that God already knows about the request, and here I'm just going to put the request again before his throne. This is monotonous. This is not going to work. All those things can create problems. But Paul didn't let those things cause him to stop praying for these Christians. He prayed for them. He prayed for them a lot. He says in Romans 1, 9 and 10, I want you to know that I'm praying for you. Now, having looked at that side of the coin, let's take a look at the other side of the coin. This same author listed some things that help him pray like Paul prayed. He said, number one, the word Father. Growing up, as you think about dad, hopefully you had a good dad, assuming that you did, you go and you talk to dad about this, or let's reverse it a little bit. You love your dad. He's now senile. And as you go see dad, he tells you the same stories. Maybe because of the Alzheimer, he tells you this, and 5 minutes later, he's telling you it again. He's telling you the story again. And before you leave, you've heard that same story 15 times. Do you look at dad and say, I'm never going to see you again? I'm tired of that story?
No.
Not if you love him. You've got that relationship there. Similar thing is true when it comes to prayer. This author talked about the example of Jesus, how that helps him pray like Paul did. He talked about answered prayer. I'm going to go out a little bit on a limb here and say I suspect that women are probably a little more prone to do this or better at doing this. Maybe that's not true. But I'm going to suggest that females are probably a little bit better about making a prayer journal. In that prayer journal, they will have some prayers that they prayed, and there are answered prayers in there. I don't know that I can ever think of a man that has told me I have a prayer journal. Now, maybe some do, maybe a lot do, and they've just never shared that information with me. But that seems to be more of a lady thing, and women, as they go through those journals, if you talk to them sometimes, you'll find these are the prayers that God has answered for me in my life. That can be helpful. It's good if you don't have a journal to at least remember that. Good study habits help this author. He said an honest attempt to live a life pleasing to God and being around praying people. That helps. You put yourself in the company of people who pray, people who want to do what's right. That's going to encourage you to live the Christian life. Anything that you want to add or ask before we continue on with Romans 1, 9 and 10? Okay. Let's talk about one of the items that Paul prayed concerning the Romans, and that was his visit to Rome. He says, I made request of God that I might visit you. That word which is translated making request meant to not only ask, it meant to beg, it meant to ask please, it meant to beseech someone. One source said it indicates an intensity of petition and earnestness of Paul the beggar. Try to put yourself in the position of these people. Paul is saying, I have begged God, from what we understand, on a regular basis to come and see you. I've pleaded with God to come over to your house. Who does that sound like, if you put that into today's terms? I've been begging to come over to your house. I've been pleading to go to whose house? Grandma's house. I want to be at grandma's house. Paul said, I've been pleading with God so that I might be able to come and be with you brethren. Do you see a contrast between that and some congregations today? Come Sunday, come Wednesday, what do you have to do with some folks? Drag them in. But Paul said, I wanted to be with you. That was something I was going to really look forward to if the opportunity were given. Paul said he wanted to be prospered. Where have we heard that word before, do you think? English and Greek. Paul said, I wanted to be prospered by God so that I could come see you. Prosper? 1 Corinthians 16, remember, verse 2, let every man give according as he has prospered. Here it means whether I will finally succeed. You also find that word over in 3 John, verse 2. You might say that Paul, as he thinks about these Christians, he says, I have a burning desire to see you. This is something that I really want. A person says this would be the best present ever. That may not have been quite true for Paul, but he's sort of thinking along those lines. When you think about Paul, here he is. He's certainly gone to a variety of places. He's seen a lot of people. Today, when people think about going from a place where they are to a place where they've never been, generally, more than likely, what's most on their mind? They're thinking, I'm going to go to that spot where I've never been, and what's going to happen? I'm going to... Why go to a place you've never been?
See what's there.
All right, see what's there. Let's see the sights. Let's eat the food. Let's experience the culture. Those kinds of things. But Paul said, I don't want to go to Rome to see the sights. I'm not coming to Rome to see the shows. I'm not coming to have just my passport stamp. Why am I coming? I'm coming to see you. I'm coming to see the people of God. How different that is from a lot of people today. One source said he longed to meet with his fellow believers. Some were his kinsmen, some had been fellow workers, some were prisoners, but all were Christian brothers and sisters. Here's Paul. He has this great desire. He's made some plans, but does he leave everything up to God? Romans 1:10, what would you say? What do we find in the text? He says, if by any means, now at length, I may be prospered, how? By the will of God. Let's ask the question again. Did Paul leave his trip that he really wanted to take up to God? He did. That should also be true for us when we pray. Our request should be stated in such a way where we are always mindful of God's will. We want what's best. We want what's right. And we submit to God. That's how Jesus lived, wasn't it? Not my will, but thine be done, as we find in the garden. One source said to find the will of God is the greatest discovery. That's true. To know the will of God is the greatest knowledge. That's true. To do the will of God is the greatest achievement. People want to do great things. They want to learn great things. But spiritually, that's where it is. You have the greatest knowledge. You have the greatest achievement. You've discovered the greatest thing if you're right with God. Okay, here is someone who says, I want to do what's right. I've got these great plans. I am willing to abide by God's will. I'm hoping that he's going to let me do this. But what does heaven sometimes say? No. We saw that from the class in Acts chapter 16 last Sunday. If you're in it, Paul wants to preach. We know that from Romans chapter 1. He says, I'm eager to preach. Saw that in Acts chapter 16, but the Spirit said, no, not here, not now. Sometimes God will say no. I may mention this again Sunday. It didn't get mentioned. We sort of ran out of time. But going back to the dog illustration, here you are. You've got the treats. The dog wants the treat. In the dog's eyes, there is a straight line from you in the box to munching on the treat, right? But in your mind, what might you be thinking? Before the dog gets the treat, what's got to be done? Well, okay, that could be. Maybe the dog has to perform a trick. Anything else? What if the dog has to be taken outside to go to the bathroom? You're going to get the treat, but we're going to have to take a little zig or zag, and after we have that little jog, then it's time to get the treat. Do you think that God sometimes works in the same way? We talk at times about God delaying prayer. That's true. Sometimes, though, there's more involved than just a delay in prayer. God may say, I see where you are. I see where you want to be. That's in accordance with my will. But we're going to have some jogs, some twists and turns. There may be some S-curves. There may be some very sharp curves. And it may be a very long road. But we will eventually get there. This, too. When you think about doing God's will, is there sometimes a part of that will that may be undesirable? Paul says, I want to go. I really want to see you. These are my great plans. I'm willing to submit to God's will. What happens, though, if you're on the ship and it sinks? God says, I'll get you there, but what's going to happen? We're going to have some zigs and some zags. It's difficult. This, again, ties to what we were talking a little bit about on Sunday. But it's difficult sometimes to know the will of God. But I want to give you some additional principles which relate to that class and to what we have in Romans chapter 1. Number one, when God has not taken, or has not, let me rephrase that, when God has not fully expressed himself as far as his will clearly on a matter, he takes full responsibility. Now, I put full there in quotes, but God's going to take responsibility. You think about a person who is looking for a job. They want to work at a shoe store. And they should say, so should I work on the shoe store that is 5 miles this way or 5 miles this way from my house? Both choices would seem to be equal. The pay is going to be equal in both places. The benefits are going to be equal in both places. It's just, which do I choose? Does God have a specific will there? Clearly, you can't go to the New Testament and say, what's God's will concerning for me as far as being employed at a shoe store. You can pray about it and see where circumstances might lead, but since there is no clear revelation, if you should have taken this shoe store over that shoe store, you're still in good shape, spiritually speaking. I've mentioned this several times before. It merits repeating tonight. God is like a train. He can run on many tracks. There is that idea wheel that we talked about last Sunday. It might be God's idea wheel for you to marry this person, to go to this school, to work in this place, to live in this state, to make this decision concerning health care. All those things might be ideal. But if you fail, going back to the preceding point, God has not explicitly told you what to do in that situation. And even if you make the choice, which is not the best choice, he's certainly able to run on more than one track. We also have to remember that sometimes in life, the choice is not good or bad, right or wrong. Sometimes the choice is what? Good, better, and best. It's wise and right to pray for what's best. If you live long enough and you make enough choices, though, sometimes you're not going to always make the best choice. We realize that. We say, I bought this one. You buy a tool, and it was the cheaper of two, and it outlasts what your neighbor bought as far as a more expensive tool. Sometimes you buy the more expensive tool and it doesn't work out and you say, I should have bought the cheaper one. I've only used it once and that was a mistake. If we're uncertain and the decision does not need to be made right away, wait for a while, see what circumstances may change. And then item number five, I think, is major in the will of God. Always try to be sensitive and mindful of God's will in your life. Remember those people over there in James chapter 2? They were business people, and what were they thinking? We're going to do what? We're going to go into a... Okay, we're going to go into a distant place, and we're going to buy, and we're going to sell, and we're going to get gain. How'd James respond to that? Your life is a vapor. You don't know that you're going to make it to the far country. Even if you do, you don't know that you're going to have the health, the strength, the resources to buy, sell, and trade. The other item that needs to be mentioned in verse 9 is what Stan was talking about earlier. Paul said he served God in his spirit or heart. That seems to be related to John 4:24, where Jesus talked about the worship. Worship God in spirit and truth. In the Hebrew letter, Hebrews 9:9, and also in Hebrews 10 and verse 2, that word describes priestly service. You'll see that word used a little later in Romans 1:25. It's there used to describe the service that Gentiles gave to the idols. Our Christian life, whether we're worshiping or not, needs to have some interest, some enthusiasm, some zest. It needs to come from the depth of who we are. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little bit? Romans 1:11 and 12. Okay. In those next two verses, Paul said, "For I long," you can again see that desire, "I long to see you that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift, to the end you may be established. That is, that I wish you may be comforted." Let's try that again, 12. "That is, that I with you may be comforted in you, each of us by the other's faith, both yours and mine." Paul said, in part, I have this great desire to come to Rome so I can give you something. What do I want to give you? I want to impart a spiritual gift. Normally when you see those words spiritual gift, what comes to mind? All right, a miraculous gift in the sense of tongues or prophecy, the discerning of spirits and those kinds of things. That could be true here. We remember from Mark 16 and verse 17 through 20, actually those verses, Jesus said those signs would be given as Christians preached the gospel. That was done as we see from Hebrews chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. We also know from Acts 8:18 that those gifts were transmitted by what means? Now when Simon saw that through the laying on of the apostles' hands, the Holy Spirit, those spiritual gifts were given. It could be, since Paul was an apostle, he wanted to transmit a spiritual gift to the Romans. I don't think, though, based on the context, that's what he has in mind. As you skip down to verse 12, moving from verse 11 for just a second, he says, "That is," or "let me explain things." He says, "I want to give you a spiritual gift." Is that singular or plural? Spiritual gifts or gift? All right, if he were talking about miraculous gifts, would you expect that to be spiritual gifts or gift?
Is he giving one to per person? Or
You would have to answer. You would think, I'm going to give you spiritual gifts. I've got gifts for the congregation. But I think as you look at that spiritual gift, it's explained in 12. He says, the gift is I'm going to comfort you. we're going to find fellowship in being together. Two, you have to look at the fact, I think, that that's expressed with a passive voice. One source said that means that I may receive comfort or strength together with you. Sometimes we find comfort or strength in being with one another. That's a gift. You might have someone who, anybody remember, if you have been married, got married, anybody remember inviting someone to your wedding that you really wanted to be there?
That we really wanted to.
Yes. I mean, hopefully you wanted all your guests to be there. But there was maybe one or two guests where you looked at the person and you thought, if nobody else comes, I really want you to be there. Maybe it was a mother, maybe it was a father, maybe it was a good friend. When Teresa and I got married, we had, I don't know, a couple hundred people, maybe a little over that. But someone that I had been in scouts with, I just really liked the guy's family. Unfortunately, he got a divorce some years later. But anyway, at that time, the family was just a superb family, and I really wanted him at my wedding. It's comforting sometimes to have people. Hospital setting, someone's going to have surgery, or someone has come out of surgery. And maybe they're just sort of groggy, but you can go up there and sit and sometimes give them comfort. When you look at what we have here, we have to conclude that Christians who are not mature have something big to offer. It's easy, I think, to look at Christians who are somewhat new to the faith and say, what can they do? Oh, we could have them mow the grass, or we could have them do some other things. But just being around somebody sometimes can be encouraging. Have them out to lunch, have them in the home, wherever that visiting might take place. Paul also said, and this is another key term in Romans 1, 11 and 12, he says that we might be established. That's going back to verse 11. That word describe the strengthening of congregations a little bit later in the book, Romans chapter 16 and verse 25. Here, it's one more way, I think, to reinforce the fact that Paul said there's, going to be this fellowship, there's going to be this friendship, and we'll be strengthened by one another. Sometimes the least tangible gifts are the best gifts. That gift might be a thank you, it might be a kind word, and here is another intangible gift. Anything that you want to add or ask before we say a few more things? Stan?
Well, Paul was a missionary, and he accepted that as his life. And so as he traveled, and he obviously did travel from town to town, he intended to stop at multiple places, and sometimes he stayed with them for some time before he moved on. But when we go out and about, I guess we should ask ourselves the question, are we prepared to spread the gospel everywhere? In other words, if I'm on my way to San Francisco and I'm driving, I'm going to stop multiple places along the way. Sometimes I might even have to stop for a while and stay before I finally get to San Francisco. And then I need to be cognizant that there's Christians there that could use my encouragement or whatever. And then ultimately when I get to where I'm going, whatever my goal is for that point. The reason I say all of that is that Paul said and told the Romans that he had these goals for seeing them. When, first of all, it's my goal to get there, and then it's my goal to do these things when I get there, but that wasn't even where he was headed for. He was headed for Spain. Rome was just a stop on the way. And do we need to follow that example?
Yes. We can maybe develop that a little bit more. My family got out of farming as far as my parents by the time I was four or five. It was very, very early in my life by the time they decided to go into something else. But as I think about a farmer, he thinks about his spread, his farm. As he goes down the road, he might look at some other farms or some other land, but for the most part, he is focused on his farm. He's thinking about his animals, he's thinking about his land, and thinking about the outbuildings and how his operation is going to work. But can you think of a different occupation? An occupation where someone not only thinks about what would be like the farmer and his land, but they're thinking about all the other things as well? wherever they go, they're thinking about their job and how it can be expanded.
Salesman.
Who?
A salesman.
That was the first thing that came to my mind. Gary, did you have the same answer?
I'm thinking a business owner that would see how other businesses are doing, what they have, what's new on the market, and no matter where he goes, he could be learning about how to grow his business.
Yeah. You're looking, let's just say sales guys for the sake of a simple illustration. You're looking, as you're thinking through business, let's pick out a business that everybody needs.
Food.
Well, okay, it's going to be kind of hard to be a grocery salesman.
How about coatware?
Coatware?
Coatware.
How about we use my illustration? Let's say a sign salesman. I'm going to help me out. So, you are a sign salesman, and you work for a sign company which can offer any kind of sign. As you're going around, what are you looking at? You're looking at signs. You're looking over there and thinking what? Oh, his sign's too small. His sign's too high. His sign's too old. His sign's too rusty. Everywhere you go, you see signs. It's so easy for the Christian to play farmer. This is our spread. This is what we're focused on. Jesus, though, says you need to be like the sign sales guy. Everywhere you go, you need to see lost people. There was, several years ago, someone on the 700 Club. And I thought, well, I guess I'm not the only one to have had this thought, but I don't even remember where I saw it. Maybe I was flipping through the channels and stopped to see what they had to say one day. But it was around Christmas time. There was a person in an escalator for a large department store like Macy's. There were people, or maybe it was outside the store. But anyway, they could just see all kinds of people in the mall. As they looked down over the escalator railing, hundreds of people apparently out there, their thought was not, let's look at the Christmas decorations. Let's look at the store sales. The thought was what? Those people are lost. Now, obviously, they didn't know every single thing about the person. There could have been some Christians in the mix, but that was their general sentiment. That's how they saw life. That's how Paul saw things. That's why, and we're going to get to that as far as the fruit that he wants to have among the Romans. Did we miss a hand there along the way or no? Okay. What else do we want to say? I wanted to give you one other thing as far as that longing. You also see that in the verses that we read, Romans 1, 11, and 12. With the exception of 2 Corinthians 5, 2, that passage always refers to congregations and congregational leaders. Paul said, I've got a longing to come to the congregation there. I've got a longing to see the leadership. How great that is for Christians to have a longing to be in a local assembly. Romans 1, 13, he says, and I would have not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purpose to come unto you and was hindered hitherto, that I might have some fruit in you also, even as in the rest of the Gentiles. Paul just continues to lather on this love for the believers at Rome. He says, not only did I have this great desire to come, he said, how many times did I want to come? I wanted to come multiple times, several times. Oftentimes I purposed to come unto you, but that had not been possible. You think Paul was someone who knew what it was like to have plans and see those plans fail? Did God let his plans fail? Yeah, it was some of the zigs and zags. The plans did not fail, but it wasn't that straight line as far as right to the doggy biscuit. He had to wait. He had to be patient, such is also true for us as we go through the Christian life. He says to these Christians, he said, I did not want you to be, what's the key word? I did not want you to be
unaware.
Some other translations will use a different word perhaps. Ignorant. He said, I didn't want you to be ignorant. If you have some people scheduled to come over at 5 o'clock tomorrow night, and they just never show up, well, unless you didn't want them to come, what are you thinking?
Something happened.
Yeah, well, what happened to them? Something didn't go right. Maybe they forgot about it, or maybe they got lost, or couldn't find the house, whatever it might be. If you have this fellow, Paul, he's been praying for them a lot, he really wants to come see him, and he doesn't show up, you're sort of thinking, what's going on? That doesn't make any sense. But Paul says, I've been hindered. It just has not worked out. As you look at that word, which is translated ignorant, Paul used that verb sometimes when he gave corrective instruction to congregations. Here it means, I want you to know. I want you to be well informed. He says, I want to come to Rome so something can happen. What is that? Romans 1:13. He said, I wanted to have some fruit. You think they had good orange trees at Rome? What's the fruit? What was the fruit?
Converts.
When you look at the New Testament, sometimes that word is associated with successful evangelism. As Stan noted earlier, Paul is this fella. He's like that sales guy who is out there searching for signs. He sees prospects wherever he goes. Rome certainly would have given him a fresh field. There would have been a number of people there who were not Jews, and he would have been able to continue to preach the gospel of Christ. Again, anything that you want to discuss before we go to 14 and 16? Gary?
That made me think of something Nariah said when he was here, that when he sees that there's a funeral in the area for a person he doesn't know, he'll go and he'll kind of make himself known or whatever. He's establishing a presence, and it shows that for people that are could be very much in need of something spiritual to help them deal with this, you know, their heart is at a, could be at a very right point in their life. So you put yourself right there, and they're like, hey, this guy spends enough time or enough care to come and do this. That means something.
Yes, it does. You're seeing, looking, and also making yourself available, to emphasize that point that you were making a moment ago. Anybody else? Glenda?
I mean, Paul's also reminding them that Jesus had Gentile blood in his lineage. Rahab.
Yeah.
Ruth, King David, but I think they need to be reminded of that because they weren't Jewish.
That's a good point. When you think about Paul, he was obviously from a strong Jewish background, and you have this fellow who's from the Jewish background writing to some Romans and says, well, you know, I might be able to drop by for 5 minutes. It's not that. He says, I want to come. I've been praying hard to God. I've been trying for a long time to come. When you have somebody tell you, going back to the grandma illustration, when you have somebody tell you that they want to come over to your house that badly, you really have to step back and say, yeah, he really has, or she, they, there's really concern there for us, there's really love for us, and we want to see that person. It had to make a huge, huge impression from that perspective as well, Jew and Gentile. Good point. Anybody else? All right, let's, with about 5 minutes left, take a look and at least get started on verses 14 through 16. Paul said, I'm a debtor. I'm a debtor both to Greeks and barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish. So as much as in me is, I'm ready to preach the gospel to you also that are in Rome. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation, to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. These three verses are an example of a text where you have information continuing to sort of stack or build on itself. In verse 14, Paul says, I am a debtor. I owe someone. If I'm a debtor, chances are I have to do something. And Paul says, I do have to do something. What was he willing to do? Because I'm a debtor, I'm willing to preach the gospel of Christ. Paul says, I'm a debtor. I'm going to preach the gospel of Christ for that reason. And how am I going to preach it? Romans 1:16 says, I'm going to preach it without shame, unreservedly. As you look at the word debtor, it has multiple senses, three different senses in the New Testament. Obviously, there's a sense of owing money. You see that sense in Matthew chapter 18 and verse 24. There's also the sense of sin. We are debtors. Remember the so-called model prayer, forgive us our debts, sins, transgressions. The third sense is here, and that sense means that a person has a sense of duty. There's a sense of obligation. There is that sense of commitment to a person. It's also significant that you have the present tense being used here. If someone says, I was a debtor, I was indebted to him, I paid the debt, we're even. A person will sometimes say, yes, you did owe me, but because of what you just did for me, debt's been paid. Or a person might say, I will be. If you do this, I'll be in your debt. But Paul didn't use the past. He didn't use the future. He uses the present. He says, I am a debtor. When I get up, as I go through my day, as the day ends, he said, I am a debtor. Is that also true for us? We're debtors to Christ? We are. If we become a Christian, that's true for every single one of us. As Paul thinks about that debt, he says, I cannot unbind myself from Christ and the mission of trying to share the gospel of Christ. Let's go back and revisit the farmer in the field. Remember him? If our mindset of Christianity is geared in that direction, where we see things basically internally, just sort of keeping things going, not trying to reach out in various ways, that's not right. It's not good, and it's a problem. But to try to be that sales guy, now somebody says, well, that's just not my personality. There are a lot of ways to reach out. Don't have to exactly behave like the sales guy, but that needs to be our mindset.
Well, I think, like Jesus said, we're this light and the salt of the earth. We need
yes.
to be an example. We can't. The farmer looking at his spread is only, he's putting the light under a bushel, basically.
Yes, he is. Nariah, as Gary mentioned, he's found one way to do that in the Cayman Islands. Whatever ways or methods we can find, are methods and ways that we need to use. Anybody else? Stan?
Well, I understand Paul being a debtor to Christ, because Christ purchased the church with his blood. That makes us all debtors to him. Why did he say, I'm a debtor to both the Greek and the barbarian?
I was just getting ready to ask that. He probably saw my notes. No, why? Why did he ask? Why did he say that? He doesn't mention the Jews, does he? You think Paul just had cut him off? Didn't love him anymore?
That's why I brought up the lineage of Christ. You know, I think there was a...
Okay. They did count, obviously. They were important to him. But why not mention him here? Why not mention him here?
They had a chance.
I'm sorry.
He was sent basically to teach the Gentiles of the Jews. Wasn't that his?
Yeah, Paul was really an apostle to the Gentiles. So there is that. Anything else?
I think he's trying to make it a contrast. You got wise and unwise. Barbarians and Greeks were at the opposite extremes of what would have been thought of as intelligence. Or maybe not intelligence, maybe that's not the right word.
We're
social class or something like that.
Yes.